It's a beautiful winter morning. Crisp sunshine, pale blue skies, a thick blanket of snow on bare trees and snug rooftops. A robin is singing on the holly tree, and inside the house, the mantelpiece is swathed in its glossy green leaves with tendrils of ivy hanging down. In the grate, the traditional Yule log is burning because today is one of the 12 days of Christmas. And this is 1843, the year that Christmas was invented. The year in which Isambard Kingdom Brunel floated out his miraculous steamship, the SS Great Britain, into Bristol docks in the presence of Prince Albert and a large crowd of well-wishers. The year Henry Foulds was born. He went on to discover that people can be identified by the unique patterns on their fingertips, giving rise to the science of fingerprinting. 1843, the year in which the world's oldest surviving amusement park, Tivoli Gardens, was opened in Copenhagen by Georg Carstensen. Tivoli included buildings in Oriental style, flower gardens, a mechanical merry-go-round, and a scenic railway. And after dark, coloured lamps and sometimes fireworks will illuminate the lake and the gardens. Today's programme is all about Christmas inventions. We have a stocking full of ingenious Christmas toys, a trip to Germany where glass ornaments and glass eyes for teddy bears are still blown by hand and lung, and some surprising thoughts on the origins of artificial Christmas trees. And we'll find out why 1843 is such an important year for lovers of the festive season. Wise man Roger Highfield doesn't agree on the date. He's the editor of New Scientist and the author of Can Reindeer Fly? A Treatise on the Science of Christmas. He thinks it goes back much further, even before the birth of Christ.
It was invented for a very good reason, along with a lot of other winter celebrations. And really, to understand Christmas, I think you've got to get into the mindset of primitive man. You've got to go back tens of thousands of years. Winter's approaching, the sun's getting lower in the sky, the number of daylight hours is reducing, you can see the leaves fall off the trees, it's getting freezing, and
there's nothing to eat.
Every winter, that's right, you faced a real chance of dying through exposure, of starvation, and it was terrifying. And once you understand that, you suddenly begin to understand all the iconography of Christmas, about why we invented rituals, really to tempt the sun to come back out again. So the plants that fascinated ancient man in a deciduous world where all the leaves were dropping off the trees were the evergreens, things that seemed to fruit like mistletoe and things like that. So you can see where the holly and the ivy came from, fir trees. And then you think, well, what else are you going to do to what sort of ritual do you have to set up to encourage the sun to come back again? Well, of course, the flame.
Yes.
And then you've got things like burning Yule logs, candles and so on, or even better, putting a candle on an evergreen. And before you know it, you can see all those things that are so familiar to us. And of course, the brilliant thing is that once primitive man started thinking, if I can guarantee that the sun will come back again by putting out these candles and all sorts of rituals to do with evergreens, and of course, lo and behold, it gets warm again and spring comes again.
So it works.
It works. I better do it again next year, except I'll make it even bigger and better. So you can see this runaway Christmas effect.
Using evergreen leaves to encourage the deciduous ones to come back in the spring is a pagan thing, as Roger says. But a Christmas tree is not complete without a set of shiny glass baubles. And these are definitely German in origin. We know where the first glass Christmas tree baubles were made, and they are still being made in the small German town of Lauscha. Lauscha nestles in the Thuringian Mountains in what was once East Germany. The town is a Christmas card in itself, surrounded by forests of fir trees, inevitably covered in snow at this time of year. Slate-grey houses line steep, winding little streets, and everyone works with glass, from the tiny, family-run workshops at the top of the mountain to the mass producers at the bottom. In fact, the town was founded in 1597 as a place to house workers for the new glass factory, which was being built there.
My name is Günter Schlüder. I was born.
My name is Gunter Schluter, and I am the director of the Glass Museum in Lauscher. There was wood here, and there was quartz sand 8 kilometres away. The ideal wood for glass was beech, because you didn't just use the wood as fuel, but they also made pearl ash out of it. Pearl ash was used as a flux, because it contains potassium, and you need potassium to make glass melt, or sodium. They didn't have sodium at the time, so they used potassium, which they got from burning beech trees. There used to be beech trees all around here, but what you see now, lots of firs, is the result of reforestation, fast-growing trees. The most common legend is that a poor glassblower who didn't have any fruits or biscuits or sweets, which is what they used to hang on their trees, he didn't have anything, so he made the fruits and sweets for himself out of glass. And that's believed to be the beginning of the glass Christmas ornament. He wasn't poor, he was very poor. Glassblowers have always been very poor because they don't get good money for the glass. And these stories about the Christmas ornaments come from this poverty.
One of the larger companies in Lauscher, Krebs, has this year made the most expensive Christmas tree bauble in the world. It's a transparent glass ball enclosed in gold filigree, encrusted with 120 diamonds, a sort of Fabergé egg for Christmas. It's worth around 20,000 euros, or nearly 16,000 pounds. Wouldn't take long to put £500,000 on your Christmas tree. But most of Krebs's Christmas decorations are more modest. Michael Krebs is one of the directors.
In this area of glass blowing, you start normally with a tube for glass Christmas ornaments, but they were prefixed with on a machine that you have a kind of flat ball on one area only open with a long stick where you can blow it. Then you heat it up on a very hot flame until it's 900 degrees warm. It's like honey then. Also the consistency is like honey. And you can free blow it. If you always turn it, you get a round article. Or you blow it in a shape, in a mold. And that gives a very nice shape then. That's the expertise of a glass blower. He knows it from the view, from the color, and how it moves when it has the right temperature. And it's actually, if you would like to try it, you can try to blow a ball, just a round ball. You are not able to do it, because you have to do it in a special way, and that's a long training. That's something you can learn, but it takes 3 years to be a glass blower, to learn it. It's a long process.
So, we've got a glass ball with a tube on each end. Once the balls have been blown, they're silvered, dipped in silver nitrate to make them sparkly. Then they're coloured and perhaps a design might be painted on, some by hand and some using an airbrush or other high-tech methods. There's a lot of computerised business going on at Krebs. Then one end of the glass tube is cut off and the other is made into that little cap that holds a wire to hang it on the tree. Nightmarishly fiddly in my experience. Glass Christmas tree ornaments aren't the only Christmassy thing made in Lauscher. Gunter Weigleit is a craftsman working in the traditional way with his wife and 3 children at his home at the top of the mountain. They spend their whole time making eyeballs for dolls and teddy bears.
Ja, meine Frau, die sortiert die Augen, die Kinder herstellen.
My wife sorts the eyes after the children have made them. She pairs them up, puts them in packs of 2. Because the eyes are made by hand, each one is unique, so she finds eyes that match one another so that the customer is happy. The raw materials come from the glass foundry here in Lauscher. That's where we get the tubes from that we use to make the eyes. But we also do a lot of other types of eyes for teddy bears and for stuffed animals. It's about making judgments. That's the trick of handcrafts. You learn how the air should feel and when you should turn the tube. It takes time before you can master it.
EC rules mean that Gunter's eyeballs are now deemed too dangerous for children's toys. So for the European market, plastic eyeballs are imported from China. Well, ironically, the Chinese import real glass eyeballs for their own market. Gunter imagines the ships pass each other in opposite directions. In his workshop, he's got a display cabinet full of toys his customers have given him. Koala bears, teddies, and all kinds of baby dolls. His eyeballs are also used for collector's bears and special porcelain dolls. But times are hard. It was easier under the communist regime.
I've always worked at home. It's nice. You can work when you want. You can get up when you want. You can have a lie down. But when you turn the gas tap off, the work stops and the money stops coming in. Then it's over. You always have to keep going. We work around the clock now. We can't do any more. In communist times in the GDR, we used to get an order saying they needed 1,000 pairs of a type of eye. So you sat down at home and made them and then sent them off when they were done. What they did with them, I don't know. There was no risk. There were always orders. We were always busy. Maybe they were chucking all our eyes in a hole in Russia. I don't know. We didn't ask. We felt safe. We got our money every month. But now we're dependent on our customers. We advertise. We have a website. Otherwise, no one would find us. How am I going to get to Hong Kong and ask people whether they want glass eyes? It all happens on the internet. And my son designed a wonderful site. And that's how the Australians found us as well. It's a fine thing. Without the internet, we wouldn't be able to sell a thing.
Down in the basement of the Museum of Childhood in Bethnal Green, there are so many goodies. I must remember never ever to bring a child down here because I shall never escape. There are prams and there are bouncy balls and a red tricycle, and then there's a tank nestling up against a covered wagon. It looks very inappropriate somehow. And there's a great glass fish tank and boxes and tiny chairs and more tiny chairs and dolls. Oh, no. Anyway, let's go in here. And this must be Catherine.
Yes. Hello.
Pleased to meet you. Now, you're the boss of all this lot, right?
Catherine Howell's job must be almost as much fun as mine. She gets to play with all these wonderful toys. She's picked out some favourite Christmas toys for us, mostly dating from the late Victorian period and beyond, because this was the time when toy making became a commercial enterprise. Before that, toys had always been homemade or craft-made. In the late 19th century in Northern Europe, children became consumers, and Catherine knows exactly what they wanted in their Christmas stockings.
Trains, yes. Now, I got two out. I got a rather old one. This would have been called a carpet train. So this would have been sort of earlier in the 19th century, maybe, 1870, something like that. It's got a very simple sort of mechanism on the bottom that made a little kicking noise.
But as it went across the carpet.
Yes,
I see.
Nothing very exotic or complicated.
It's basically a locomotive which has a barrel with sort of grooves down it, and it's sort of gold colour, a bit battered now, and a tender behind, painted red, and rather simple wheels, and nothing else to it. Obviously you could put things in there and you could tow them around the carpet.
But very simple.
Very simple.
A push-pull toy.
But now this one is about twice the size, and can I touch it?
You can.
Wow, it weighs about a kilogram. That's really heavy and chunky, isn't it?
Yes, and that's mostly the mechanism inside, of course, the clockwork mechanism.
So this is clockwork, and this, in principle, will wind up and go rattling around, and it presumably needs rails, then?
It has rails, yes.
Because that would just slide about on the carpet.
It would. You can put it on the carpet, but they did make rails for it, yes.
And
yes.
Where does this come from?
This is actually a German one. There were a couple of very famous German toy companies who made trains. This is Bing, who were based in Nuremberg in Germany, and they were one of the first companies to produce these wonderful trains. But of course, they produced them for the British market.
Well, it's called King Edward VII.
That's right. Yes. That dates it as well, so we know it's very very early 20th century.
This one's clockwork. Did they get fancier than that?
Well, indeed, yes. They had all sorts of different ways to make trains move. They used methylated spirits.
Methylated spirits.
Yes, I know.
A sort of
burner.
Steam engine. Right. Terrifying. Gosh.
Very dangerous, I think.
Yes.
They use them in boats as well. They have boats and
I had one of those. I had a little pop-up boat meter fuel it had, rather than maths, but the same stuff, essentially.
Yes.
Mind you, in the bath, it's not going to catch fire, is it? It's fairly safe. But one of these going under the sofa, you'd be in deep trouble.
Could catch fire.
Easily.
Yes.
What do we have next?
Well, of course, talking about trains, you can't not mention Frank Hornby.
Wonderful chap.
Yes, absolutely.
Liverpool, yes.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. Because he started, and what we've got here is that this is his first invention, so to speak, Meccano.
Right.
Which dates right to the start of the 20th century, 1901.
1901. Was it called Meccano at the beginning?
It was Mechanics Made Easy.
Right.
And he had this idea, that, and it was a toy for a boy. It was definitely a boy's toy.
Yes.
And marketed as such. But he wanted, you know, boys to learn proper engineering, and he went to a lot of trouble to design it so that it was like the real thing.
I loved my... Can I open it?
You can.
Oh, you're very kind. I loved my Meccano set. We had a huge one because I inherited it from my brother, and every now and then got some more bits.
Oh, you had these huge, massive wooden boxes.
We had a huge wooden box. Lovely.
Yes.
Meccano, registered all over the world. Engineering for boys. Yes, definitely. Cranes, bridges, towers, aeroplanes, wagons and signals. Instructions, yes, I love them. I made a clock out of Meccano once, and I won the holiday hobbies competition at school. Oh, look. Oh, it takes me straight back. So, we've got straight strips, which are either silver or green, and they come, there are holes drilled every half inch, and they come in 6-inch lengths and foot lengths. Screwdriver, these wheels here, and some of them are pulley wheels, and then nuts and bolts, and a spanner to hold the nut. I learned so much. And a little bent bit. And this just made a huge difference when you were in a tight corner. And a few plates here. Oh, it's lovely. Christmas wouldn't be complete without a cracker and a really bad joke. There aren't too many Christmassy inventions which can be pinned down to one individual, but the cracker can. Its inventor was a baker named Tom Smith from Clerkenwell in London. Tom Smith made wedding cakes and sold sweets too, the fancy bonbons wrapped in twists of coloured paper that the French had made fashionable. In the early 1840s, he started putting mottos inside the sweets, perhaps inspired by Chinese fortune cookies, and then later came up with the idea of making a snap to imitate the sound of a fire crackle. Two strips of cardboard were loosely glued together in a thin sandwich with saltpetre as the filling. When you pull them apart, the saltpetre explodes to produce the cracking sound. This frivolous concoction became incredibly popular and has remained so, with a brief period of austerity during the Second World War when cracker production was temporarily halted. Balloons, on the other hand, underwent some innovation at this time because of the various military uses they had as targets and decoys. Balloons were invented by the great natural philosopher Michael Faraday, who used caoutchouc bags to store hydrogen in. He found they floated and had considerable ascending power, but I don't suppose he ever imagined they might be used as a festive decoration. When Joseph Swan invented the light bulb in 1879, I don't imagine he anticipated it would be used on Christmas trees, but it was, and pretty quickly too. His rival and later partner, Thomas Edison, was more of an entrepreneur than Swan, and so were his top executives. One of them, the vice president of the electric company, was Edward H. Johnson. He came up with a novel idea of using electric lights for Christmas purposes in 1882. There's a wonderful description of his nausea-inducing Christmas tree innovation in the Detroit Post and Tribune.
At the rear of the beautiful parlours was a large Christmas tree presenting a most picturesque and uncanny aspect. It was brilliantly lighted with many coloured globes about as large as an English walnut and was turning some 6 times a minute on a little pine box. There were 80 lights in all encased in these dainty glass eggs, equally divided between red, white and blue. As the tree turned, the colours alternated, all the lamps going out and being relit at every revolution.
The first ever Christmas tree lit by electricity must have been quite a sight. Of course, matters of taste are all important when decorating your home for Christmas. Christine Lalumia is the queen of Christmas decor. She's the deputy director of the Jeffrey Museum in London, a wonderful place set in an 18th century almshouse dedicated to the interior design of middle-class English living rooms through the centuries. Each year, the rooms are decorated for Christmas in period style, and the changes through the centuries are very striking. But there are some constants.
The centrality of light at Christmas,
really?
I think, is really important. So if you think about it now in our overlit world, that was an underlit world.
Yes.
And, of course, even your home, which you'd taken great trouble and expense to light with a roaring fire and candles if you could afford them was probably a pretty dark place.
Horrible,
so extra light during this 12-day festival was really special and quite magical. I think that's what tinsel is. The earliest tinsel, I think, is an attempt to bring more sort of glitter, sparkle, reflection into either a tree or a dark corner.
Tell me about lametta.
Ah, lametta. Well, lametta is these long strips, essentially, of silver that you would hang in the tree. And that has a very ancient pedigree, you know, centuries and centuries old, apparently from Germany. And lametta, again, has to do with light. We have, I don't know if you want to look at something.
Oh,
we have,
wonderful.
Let me just
That's
get
terrific.
It.
It's deadly poisonous. It's made of lead or something.
A lot of these early Christmas decorations are poisonous because they have lead or mercury in the glass baubles. They didn't have a big health and safety push around Christmas decorations. But this lametta, which is in its original packaging, was bought in the 1930s. And it's a real lovely thing. You can see how delicate the little strips are.
Very delicate strips.
And they haven't tarnished at all.
And it's not like tinsel, which has sort of furry bits. This is just straight metal strips.
Straight metal strips.
And you hang them over the branches.
Exactly.
And they dangle down. It's like sort of almost like rain, silver rain falling from the tree.
Or icicles.
Or icicles.
Or icicles. And really silver. Apparently, silver was used.
Was it?
Right up into the middle of the 20th century. Gosh. It's very interesting. Man is always searching for novelty. So no sooner had Victoria and Albert introduced real fir trees and popularized them in domestic settings, do people sort of two or three decades later in the 60s and the 70s start looking for something novel. So artificial trees sort of grow in ingenuity and right up until the 1930s until they become small and quite choice and select, fitted with little baubles, little tapers, glass ornaments, often of German manufacture and absolutely beautiful. And the one we have right here in front of us is really tiny treasure made of sort of bristle brushes of the type that they made toilet cleaner brushes.
Oh, wonderful. Can I pick that up with the base?
By the Addis Company.
Right.
With your gloves on, of course.
With my gloves on.
Isn't that a beauty?
That is lovely. So this is really just a toilet brush. And it's funny because it doesn't look really a bit like a tree, does it? I mean, it's a symbol of a tree.
It's interesting that this is why I think we've lost touch a little bit with some of the ancient traditions and customs, because some of them have been reduced down to their sort of symbolic form, their essence, as it were. And so, as you say, these little bristle brush trees don't fool anyone.
No.
But what they mean gladdens the heart if you wanted to. It's very interesting.
Yes, odd, isn't it? Mm. Strange thing.
Mm.
Wow, Christmas reduced to a toilet brush. All right, now, I've been teasing you with a date for the invention of Christmas, the festival as we know it today. That year is 1843, and this is Christine Lelumier's theory.
That seems to me to be this, like, wonderful moment when all sorts of Christmas inventions and ideas are coming to fruition, or they're in their bright first spark moment. The cracker, the Christmas cracker.
Right.
The first printed Christmas card is designed and sent in the early 1840s by Henry Cole, the great Henry Cole, who founded the Victoria and Albert Museum. Scrooge, of course, A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, Victoria and Albert in the 1840s, in the early 1840s.
They were married in 1840, weren't they? Something like that,
They're married, and then they have their first tree, and they start having children, and they start moving, repositioning Christmas from being a celebration for adults, which it was in sort of pagan England, and then in the 17th and 18th century, it was really an adult celebration, to it being about family and children. So the early 1840s and 1843 in particular, a red letter year for Christmas.
So, as far as the fripperies of Christmas are concerned, year zero, the Eureka year, is 1843, the year of cards, crackers, and Dickens's Christmas Carol. But if we want to discover when Christ's birthday really was, we must look at the Bible for an authoritative date. New Scientist editor Roger Highfield has the last word.
The problem is that when you look at the Bible, there's not quite enough information to pin down exactly what they're talking about. For me, interestingly, the most persuasive theories are actually astrological theories, because right. I think that this is a guy called Mike Molnar at Rutgers University, is a famous proponent of this. He said, look, you've got to look at the heavens from the perspective of the wise man and not of the modern astronomer.
Right.
And they weren't saying that's a planet, that's a star, that's a galaxy. They were interested just in points of light and the patterns made by the points of light. First of all, Mike Molnar searched for a kind of regal star, and actually that was really the planet Jupiter fitted the bill, and that played a central role in horoscopes at the time, even though obviously it wasn't a star. And he actually focused on things called lunar occultations. That's when the moon's disk obscures the planet, because these were supposed to have great significance. And he found two that took place in the constellation of Aries, which represented Judea, in 20th of March 6 BC and 17th of April 6 BC. And in fact, when he looked into it a bit more deeply, he found that Jupiter was in the east, just as Matthew uses to describe the Magi's star, on the 17th of April, on 6 BC. So putting all these astrological portents together, that was the day that he believes that Christ was born.
Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? Intriguing. I was lucky. I was in Death Valley one night, 30 miles from another human being, absolutely dark. And it was a full moon, and Mars was in conjunction with Jupiter. And it was absolutely stunning, you know. Jupiter is very bright. And you just thought, wow, something special.
We can forget, given that most of us now, unfortunately, labour under a kind of sodium glow sky that washes out any detail. Just what a marvellous thing the night sky is when it's not polluted by light. And what a majestic thing it is. And so it's very easy to understand why the ancients were so gripped by the signals and signs that they saw in the heavens.
The Eureka Years at Christmas was presented by Adam Hart-Davis. The readers were Chris Ledyard and Nigel Bowler. The producer in Bristol is Mary Ward-Lowry. And this programme is Radio 4's podcast choice of the week. For more details, go to the Radio 4 website.